we have the board. Just a minute, let's not, I want to write those names down.
It's the same group. Yes, same group, same people. I can't identify the others, you know.
What is Busselman?
Busselman is this man. He was supervisor for years from San.
Oh, yeah, no, just read his articles.
And his, Ada, his wife was,
Yeah, right.
Quite a writer.
Yeah.
And she was on the school board for the community college.
You know who this is here?
I do not, no, yet his face is familiar.
Busselman is the only one you recognize.
That's the only one, yes. And of course, my cousin. You had him identified, Fred.
Well, that, yeah, that's Fred.
Okay.
And Fred is your first cousin?
First cousin, yes.
And his father and your father?
Were brothers.
Were brothers, came from
Wales.
Mm-hmm. And you were born in Wales?
No, I was born in Mill Valley.
But Fred was born in Wales.
Fred was born in Wales, yeah.
Yeah.
Fred,
it was a difference of time. Your father came several years ahead of.
Yeah, my father came first when he was in his about 20. And the family in Wales were all Masons, Brick Masons and the like. My father prospected for metals in Montana for about a year, and then he came to San Francisco, left married my mother, and then they settled in the valley. And he went into the Mason business, Berkeley and in plaster. Short, husky, strong, industrious as hell.
You have any idea what drew him to Mill Valley?
I do not. I've been asking myself that question. I do not know. He met and married my mother, but shortly in San Francisco. She was a San Francisco native. And shortly after they moved to Mill Valley, they rented a little house up on the stairs going up to Summit School. House later on occupied by Shorty Johnson, you remember Shorty Johnson?
Mm-hmm.
He was a boy of my age. Next to Odell Abraham, the beloved school teacher.
Was that the stairs that went up next to the library or the
right
stairs that went up by Bernard?
No, next, right back of the library. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
We used to use that to go.
They come up right by the O'Shaughnessy property.
That's right. There. O'Shaughnessy was the ex-city engineer for San Francisco, I think.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right alongside of the O'Shaughnessy property.
Did you recognize?
No, I didn't recognize him at all.
Looks like a Barrymore.
Yeah, quite a trooper. And while this house looks familiar, I can't identify it.
There was one name associated with this package when it came in. It was the name of, maiden name of Fred's wife. Was that Montan or?
No, Alina, that's in the middle. Alina, she just passed away a couple of months ago. Until she was Alina, Helena.
E-L-L?
I think it was H-E-L-E-N-A. Alina. Huntoon, H-U-N-T-O-O-N. Her father was the president of the Bank of Mill Valley before it became a part of Bank of America. He and Frank Ankers, was his chief helper, operated that bank. They were very prominent in masonry. And that's when my cousin T. Fred Bagshaw became pretty well acquainted and eventually married Alina.
When would that be, in the 20s?
Their marriage, let's see, I married the first time in 29. And I'm quite confident I'm correct, Fred married it about the first time about 32. Relatively late marriage.
This would be a little before then, I guess, or about that time.
I
would think so. I don't recognize the other two girls, but the center is certainly Helena.
There's a name on the back.
Not connected with the bag shows, no. Well, again, we have Helena here in the center. Helena and Toon. I can't identify either of the men. Same is true of this. Helena in the middle. And Helena. Have you talked with Sam Bagshaw about these?
No, I haven't. I thought it came to mind that he might.
I think he'd be more apt to.
Seems to be on that side of the
phone. Identify them than myself.
Yeah.
And I know Sam is most cooperative.
Yes, he's puts in some hours there at the library.
Quite active, yeah. He's a patient in a rest home down there at the. Near McCann's Grove?
Yeah, well, he comes into the library every Saturday morning and acts as a docent there in the history room. I don't think those are Marin County.
Well, this one isn't. No, this isn't Marin County.
No, it didn't seem to be so to me either. In fact, the back says Cambridgeport, Massachusetts. But
was this yours?
The Bay State. Oh yeah, that's some notes I made.
There's some names on the back, and it's so you won't be able. I don't think you can make those out.
It's an old streetcar, not rather an old railroad car. Alex Fuller, Patty Fuller, Mrs. Hayes.
Miss and Mrs. Rockwood.
Rockwood. Mrs. Rockwood again. Miss and Mrs. Rockwood.
Yeah.
None of the names I associate with.
Well,
and this is.
That looks a little before our time, your time, too.
Here's Helena right in the front row. It's her class picture. Helena was younger than me. So I wouldn't be able to identify the children of the children.
This was certainly a class picture.
Yeah.
How much younger?
I think Helena was perhaps 5 years younger than me.
That would make her, this is probably about the eighth grade.
I would say it's the eighth grade. It'd be about 1913. Let's see, I graduated from grade school. 1908. Yeah, but 1913. She had a brother, too.
Could that be Summit School?
I would
the
say
hill looks like it might
yes,
be
I
behind.
I would say it was definitely Summit School, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, Sam could probably help you a great deal more with these.
I'll try him on that.
T. Fred Bagshaw was very much a family man, a young boy. He took over the management of his family. His father was a nice fellow, but ineffectual sort of. It was Tom. And T. Fred went to school, left school and went to work early and prospered, did fairly well, and took over complete management and control of his branch of the Bagshaw family. Sam and Sid sometimes tell me about this now. Among other things, he invested their money and lost it. They still resent it. But he had a romantic affair with Hattie Crosgrove. Does that name mean anything?
Sure does.
Yeah.
What is the name?
Hattie Crosgrove.
Lived at the corner of Hill and Blithedale.
Right. And she played the piano for the
Hub
Theater. She played for it when it first down below Brady's Saloon, next to White's stable, Charlie White's stable.
That would be down near where Brown's store is now, the furniture store.
Yeah. And she played just the mechanical piano there, and then when it moved up to, how can I describe it? Near Dowd.
Across from Dowd's, at the corner of...
Well, before it went across from Dowd, it was right next to Dowd.
Oh.
In a half a store building. And Hattie played there, I remember seeing the Pearl White series there with Hattie playing. And then they built the new Hub Theater across the street, and she played there. And Fred went with her for many, many years. And as a matter of fact,
granddaughter married John George, who was at Tam High School from probably about 1932 to 1970-some-odd.
Mm.
And I obtained a photograph of that old house from her, along with two or three other photographs.
The old Crosby.
And there's a copy of a sheet of music written by Anson Weeks, and the photograph on the cover is the band of
the
Walter Krausgrill at the Something Ballroom in San Francisco, and Phil Harris was in that orchestra.
I have read his, or I listened to him on television here within the past week or 10 days, and This Is My Life or something like that. Phil Harris said he broke in with the Walter Krausgrill Orchestra.
Did he?
Yeah.
I'll be darned. Because, yeah, and his picture, we have that picture on the, and we're setting it up for the history room to keep it, of Walter Krausgrill. And I have a picture of the house the way it was when it was first built before. And Dr. Cudworth, the dentist, remember?
Yes.
He lives at Emory, lives in that house now. He's been the only other owner. It was transferred from Krausgrill to Cudworth, whose family was also early. They lived up on Lovell, if you remember.
I don't remember where they lived. Now, Hattie Krausgrill had a younger sister who married. She must be the mother of the girl whom you just mentioned.
Edna,
yes. And they had a house right down across from Hanson's on local, on
Lake. She married Fred Glahn.
Glahn, that's right.
G-L-A-H-S.
Yeah, I remember when they built the house.
1924. House was built in 1920. I got all that information.
Did you make a phone call recently to Tom Deffenbach, trying to find out when the Boyle House was built across?
Yeah.
Huh?
Somebody did. I don't know. I gave Tom's name to Henry Boosie, who's writing up this material.
Well, Tom, we had dinner with him Sunday night, and he said he'd received this phone call. And he's much younger than I am. He couldn't remember when it was built, but I felt certain it was pursuant to what you're contemplating doing. I can fix within a year or so when it was built. It was built about the same year, either the same year or the year prior to the building of the Park School.
Okay, and that was in 1909. If I've got the date, I know I might be off a year or two, but
yes,
I've got
it
written somewhere.
Be about it. But then, 1908 or 1909. It was just newly constructed when I entered the Park School, and that was when it first opened.
I was wondering what, in the days we're talking about now, Mine don't back as far as you, but still, 4th of July, Memorial Day, in those days was something quite different today. What was Memorial Day in Mill Valley?
I don't recall Memorial Day, I guess because it wouldn't appeal to a kid, but I remember the 4th of July, as well as the celebration of the end of World War I. It was all held in Lytton Square. They would build a temporary platform there. They'd have a band, a volunteer band of Mill Valley play, and the steam calliope that the fire department had for a steam pump would come pumping around, and the fire a wagon would come through, originally drawn by horses, and everybody climbing on it. Later they had a motorized.
This was the 4th of July?
Uh-huh. Yeah. And then they'd have a parade, and of course, considerable drinking, and a big baseball game.
What did Lytton Square look like then?
Well, Lytton Square...
The train came in there at that time.
Well, it came into where the present Greyhound Depot is there. That's, yeah. At that time, the railroad depot was a big, old, wooden, yellow building. And it was located just where the present station is built. That was its successor. Lytton Square was about as big as it is now. I remember when they built the Keystone Block, it really made the square. It was before World War I. And there was no flagpole in the middle of it. We used to play tops and marbles in the middle of it. And of course the Mountain Railway came across one end of it. It was oil and tar and gravel, no pavement. But other than that, it was much the way it is now.
Was Miller paved?
No, none of the streets were paved.
When do you remember the streets being paved?
Well, I would say that it was...
Of course, some of them are very well paved now.
I would say that they were paved in about 1910, because that's when we moved back to Mill Valley. We'd moved out of it for a while to Alto and moved back. And it was paved then because we used to spin our tops there and we couldn't spun them on the...
Yeah. You're speaking now of downtown. Not out Blythedale or up Summit.
No,
or any
right
of those
in Lytton Square.
Just yeah. Lytton yeah. Square.
Named after Lytton Barber.
Yeah.
It wasn't called a square or anything else, and it was just a wide street.
What do you think about the suggestions been made to change Lytton Square to Eastland Plaza or some sort? Have you heard of that?
No, I haven't.
No, I don't think the idea was to change it. The new plaza, the bricked area where the trains used to park in front of the depot, that's what they're talking about. Leaving Lytton Square would remain where the in front of the Keystone building, but on the other side of the depot building,
yeah, I know what you mean.
That new they've paved it.
Well, it's
it's a plaza,
but it's generally known when you say Lytton Square, you kind of think of the whole area, don't you?
I don't disagree with you, but what they're talking about,
okay.
Though, the name.
Well, no, I wouldn't.
Yeah,
you see, Lytton Square is distinctly now. When the rail electric trains were still running in there, whereas you say they parked, there were the two tracks coming in, and then there was the Mountain Railway track coming down, and there was a big circular rock with iron chain in between it and a watering trough for horses there. Very ornamental, very attractive, and then maybe 100 feet below, there was another square around a lot of redwood trees. I guess the redwood trees are still there.
Yeah.
But and the horse taxis and later the automobile taxis used to back up to that, pick up their fares, you see.
Uh-huh.
And that was distinctly the railroad property where the hikers gathered waiting for the trains on weekends. But Lytton Square was separate and distinct by itself.
But describe Lytton, where you... For me, exactly where Lytton Square is, because I kind of gave it a general...
If this is the depot building,
right.
And here's the Keystone building,
right.
And the Miller
right.
Avenue is out here, Throckmorton goes up
right.
This way. Well, this is Lytton Square.
Lytton Square.
Right. It was terminated by the old Mountain Railway.
Yeah, the railroad came in this way.
Right.
And this is the area that is being made into a plaza with brick flooring, benches, trees, lighting.
And kids with skateboards.
And kids are now on there with skateboards. But this is what they're
trying to decide what to call it.
Yeah. And one of the suggestions has been Eastland Plaza, because there's nothing named for Eastland.
Now, what is the origin of that name? Eastland is so common. Was it,
well,
when I was a kid, was
the town was called Eastland at
was,
one time.
Is that so?
And Eastland was one of the three founders.
Eastland was a realist. Well, he was a bank president in San Francisco. And the bank, when Throckmorton died, he owed the bank considerable money for land deals. So the president of the bank, who was Eastland, and several of the directors on their own, this is the history that I read, took over and paid his loan, Throckmorton's loan off, and then they took the property, which was most of what was Mill Valley at that time. And then they subdivided it and sold lots.
Because I remember from the very first, the Eastland Bakery was the old bakery on the Miller there, operated by German people. Grethel. Hacks came later. Grethel's owned it originally, and then the Hacks bought it. And the other side was the modern bakery. The Pacific Market was in between.
Yeah.
Boy.
That's where the bank, Wells Fargo Bank, and Lockwood's is now.
Lockwood's is where the Pacific Market was. The bank is at the location of Brady's famous old saloon. Get away from those swinging doors.
Well, you went to what education did you have in Mill Valley?
I graduated from the grade school with the two Seymour twins that I was thinking of, the only two that are alive that I know of in my class. I had the honor of graduating with them. We were the only three graduated with honors. And then my father was a mechanic, a building man, and he wanted my brother, a year older than myself, to attend a trade school. Dick Wilmerding was a famous school in San Francisco.
Oh, yeah.
High school, and with an excellent reputation.
Still is.
So my father was a Welshman. Church of England was his faith. And my maternal grandmother was Irish and as Catholic as my father was, Church of England, and they battled constantly. So when we graduated from grammar school, my father and my mother were divorced. My father offered to pay my brother's way through Lick Bulmerding. I don't know why we didn't go down to Talmapais, except that only a few years prior to that it had been a tent school, a big tent on a platform, was the way it originated. So it wasn't very firmly established. But in any event, my father sent my brother over to Lick Wilmerdine, and my Irish grandmother said, well, Albert's going to go there too. And I wasn't inclined at all to the trade show. So we both went there 1 year, and during that year, both my father and my maternal grandmother became tired of financing us, and they just ceased to finance us. So we quit school.
Did you go by train and ferry to school back and forth every day?
By train and then a streetcar out to Geary to Van Ness and transferred to the Van Ness over to the Potrero, yeah.
Gee, that's quite a trip.
It was a trip, yes.
A couple-hour trip.
And it was expensive, too, for people who didn't have it, and we didn't have it. So I went out with only 1 year of high school, and I worked for 5 or 6 years and became somewhat ashamed of myself. Realized I was making no progress. I was having a lot of fun. So I won't put this in the record. I was working for a Jewish wholesale silk house, Clayburgh Brothers in San Francisco. And the assistant manager was an Irishman, later went to prison. Wasn't too honest. And he'd work the kids, we were stock boys, though we were, you know. And he'd work us at night filling orders or taking inventory, and he'd always during Prohibition, and he'd start a crap game, and he'd also open one of the boss's bottles of whiskey and treat us, you know. He'd start a crap game, and he'd clean us. So he cleaned me of 2 weeks' salary that my mother needed very badly. And I was so ashamed of myself that I didn't go home that night. One of my friends had told me of old Sandy Mason's University had a night law school. And they would accept you in as a special student with a high school diploma. But you'd only get a certificate of graduation after 4 years, unless the faculty unanimously voted you a degree. So relying upon that, I went out and enrolled at the old St. Ignatius without presenting credentials from high school. And I went there for 4 years at night. And
at night, you're working someplace.
Oh, I'm working all the time, yes. After 2 years at the night at the school, I moved over into a room on Oak Street, and I only came home on weekends. At the end of 2 years, realizing that my work in wholesale so-called was not helping me in my law studies, I wanted to work for an attorney, and I tried to get a job in an attorney's office, and they all wanted to almost charge me desperately, you know, I had nothing of value. So one of them said to me, look, son, if I were you and your age, I'd study to be a secretary, shorthand typing, and get on the staff of some corporate executive. And he said, I'll wager in 20 years you'll have attorneys on your own staff. So it impressed me that it was sound. So I got the wholesale silk house, let me work from 1 until 6, and Saturdays half day. So I enrolled in the Saline Johnson Secretarial School on Geary Street. The two old maids gave me a key to the place so I could come in at 7, practice my typing until they took up their teaching activities at about 8:30. Got off at 12, went down to my silk house job and earned my living. So I did that 4 or 5 months, and Saline Johnson were so cooperative that they sent me to be over to the United States Marshal, Fred Asilva, political appointee during the Hoover administration. And he needed a male secretary. So I went to work as a secretary, and he needed a secretary like a bald-headed man needs a comb. He couldn't dictate in the first place. So I'd listen to his mumbling jumbling, and I'd compose a letter, and he was very pleased with it, you know.
What year about would this be?
That would have been about 19...
Have to be in the late 20s. If it was during the Hoover administration.
Well, no, I was in that Hoover administration for a long time. Let's see, to St. Ignatius in 1922, the U.S. Marshal's office in 1924. And are you interested in all this?
Very much, exactly, well, exactly.
I worked for the Chief Deputy Marshal, was the... the man the Department of Justice and the Treasury Department had insisted the marshal appoint. He was a career man from Alaska. But the marshal, you know, is the dispersing officer for the federal courts. He pays jury fees, witness fees, cost of prisoners and the like, judges' salaries. And he's under heavy bond. And Fred Asilva was not a capable man in that way, an administrative way. His accounts were fouled up, so they compelled him to appoint John Rosine as chief deputy. And John Rosine lifted me and made me his assistant, you see. Well, to bring it to a close, during that 2 years, I was in the federal court building constantly. I had met and made a friend of Edgar Bonner, who was the agent in charge of the FBI for Northern California. A career man, and in an effort to make prohibition, which was a disgrace at the time, the effort to make it a success, they started appointing career men to top spots in the prohibition administration, and they appointed Ed Bonner as administrator for Northern California and all of Nevada. That was the year I graduated from St. Ignatius. I had a hell of a time. When I graduated, St. Ignatius had become a real school. They had become the University of San Francisco, building. So the new prefect, in going over the graduates, noticed I hadn't submitted my credentials from high school. So he sent for me. So he wanted the credentials. And I said, I didn't have any. So he said, well, we can't graduate you then. Well, my maternal grandmother almost ceased to be a Catholic over, because frankly, I was among the five top students for the entire 4 years. So he said, after the graduation, the summer vacation, if the faculty votes you a degree, unanimously, we'll give you one. So I went to the toughest of the faculty, a man by the name of Bill Breen, who was in Theodore Roach's office. He taught real property. And I thought I'd nick the toughest one first. And I went to Breen and told him what my problem was. And he said, this man next door, Theodore Roach, do you remember my name?
I remember the name.
Oh, he was the outstanding trial attorney in Northern California. He's this man, never went to law school. He read law in somebody's office. Who can say that he doesn't adequately represent his client? And he said, I'll not only vote for a degree, but I'll see if I can't get the ball rolling for you. And he called up every member of the faculty and added his recommendation. I got
It would help. We have been putting much, and it would make it easier when it comes to be used for us.
Well, as I've said before, I was born in Mill Valley at a house on Blythedale Avenue of what is now the corner of Sycamore on April 7th, 1902.
We're almost up to your birthday.
Day after tomorrow, my 81st birthday. My father had migrated from Scotland, Wales, at about the age of 20, had settled first in San Francisco, where he met my mother, whose name was Marie Louise Campbell. They had married, and what attracted them to Mill Valley, I don't know, but shortly after their marriage, they moved to Mill Valley and settled in a house up near Summit Avenue, a rented house, where my sister Rose, Marie Bagshaw, now age 85 and still alive, but unfortunately very ill, she was born there. Shortly after her birth, my mother and father purchased about 2 acres of land on Blythedale Avenue, as I said before, at its present intersection with Sycamore. And my father built a small frame house there, and we moved there to live. My father was then engaged in the contracting business as a bricklayer and plasterer. He was a tremendously energetic man, powerful, short in stature, but very powerful. He worked as hard as he also played. Wine, women, and song, I think, in those orders, and work, and he prospered. He, for reasons I don't know, in about 1905, he purchased some land at Alton Station outside of Mill Valley, and built a very substantial structure thereon, a two-story wood frame building with wide verandas, known as the Alto Inn. It was a typical roadside inn with the broad porches, verandas covered with outdoor furniture. The main steps led up to the bar room proper, which was in the corner. The big rustic
Excuse me, when you say he built it, he had it built, he contracted it, he was a carpenter?
No, my father did a lot of building, speculative building. He could do a great many things in the building trade, but he had a crew who worked with him. His master carpenter was a fellow by the name, man by the name of Santis, who lived on the road to Tiburon, approximately 1 mile from...
What was that, S-T-A-T?
S-A-N-T-O-S. I believe his first name was Joe.
That sounds like a Latin.
Portuguese.
Portuguese, distinctly Portuguese, to further identify him, his only child, his son Joe, a couple of years older than myself, eventually built and operated for years a service station at the corner of Blythedale and the old Corte Madeira grade. There's a service station there now. He lived there with his wife, and Joe Santos, the son, his wife and children. He prospered tremendously, and he later bought the land and constructed the, I believe it's called the El Camino Motel on Lincoln Avenue in San Rafael.
The corner of Mission and
Lincoln. The corner of Mission. It was the finest rooming place for many years in Marin County. All the judges stayed there. I don't know whether Joe Santos is still alive or not. He taught me how to use a BB gun. And then many years later, he taught me how to hunt ducks. That man could get ducks when no one else could.
He'd be an old man if he was alive today.
He'd be an old man. I know his son is alive, selling insurance, because I recently heard of him. Very fine, a fine family.
You're talking now about the son of the Santos that worked for your father.
That's right. In later years, the Santos that worked for my father, he and my father built around the Locust Avenue section, built eight or nine homes on speculation, usually for rental purposes. But my father built and operated the Aldo Inn, and he moved the family out there when I was about three, and we stayed there until six, until I was 6 years of age. At that time, Blythedale Avenue was extended underneath the railroad tracks, up beyond the Aldo Station, where it divided. One dirt road went over to Tiburon, substantially the same route the present road follows. The other road paralleled the railroad tracks up towards the entrance to the railroad tunnel. And there it separated, one branch going over the Corte Madeira grade to serve Corte Madeira and Ross Valley, and the other going to the right over to where the present 101 goes over the hill there and to Greenbrae and thence to San Rafael. And these were dirt roads, and the Aldo Inn was suitably situated right at their intersection. It was a carriage house sort of a thing. Traveling salesmen, cookie dispensers and the like would leave their teams there. They had stables and stalls for the horses, carriage sheds for the carriages. And they'd leave their teams there at night and take the train into San Francisco and back in the morning and continue the route. We stayed there until I became 6 years of age and needed schooling, and my brother had been held back a year because of me. And then my father built, with the help of Joe Santos, a very substantial home on Locust Avenue. It was at what is now the corner of Lock Lane. It had 13 rooms, two stories, the full basement. Of course, it had no central heat, but it was a very substantial house. It's in deplorable condition from what I can see of it now. We maintained a horse by the name of Ned, who drew a buggy one day, a wagon the next day, and a plow the next. And my father rented from the Defebacks about 20 acres of land right behind our house. On that 20 acres, there was a substantial orchard with several stockpiles of adobe brick, which had been taken from some adobe building which they had demolished. At the extreme westerly end of that piece of land, there was the Indian burial ground, covered about 3 or 4 acres. We called it the rancherie. The material from that ground was ashes and shell, bones and skeletons and the like, but the material was excellent for paving purposes in those days, concrete not being so prevalent. So Tom Defebacks Sr., who had the stable in Mill Valley proper, had a very profitable business selling this rancherie or shell mound. We also called it shell mound.
Where would that be on the plot today?
It would be the house of Compare. It would be the extension of, is a sycamore that extends.
It would be right about where
Hemisita and Sycamore.
That's right.
Come in.
Uh-huh. That's right. It's all built up now, but in those days, the burial ground was very substantial in size, was excavated by Deffenbach.
And Deffenbach lived on Sycamore, just a couple of houses
in later
west,
years.
West of. Locust.
Yeah, in later yeah. years, though. Who moved down there later?
The Tom that you had dinner with the other night
is
grew
his
up
son.
There.
That's yeah. right. Grew up there. That's right. And
their heirs or descendants of old Captain John Reed.
That's right. They are direct descendants of the Reeds. Yeah. For example, the Billion, there were only two tennis courts in Marin and Mill Valley in those days, and one was the Billions. Ward tennis court up on the Old Mountain Railway, and that was surfaced with this ranchery, as we call it, shell mound. So it had to be rolled before every game and resurfaced with chalk. The other tennis court was John Finn's down on Miller Avenue, and that was surfaced with some blacktop. But in any event, we used to play cowboy and Indians on that shell mound, that burial ground, with wooden rifles. And of course, we used to dig for artifacts and find many of them. In the meantime, my father used the rest of the acreage, which he rented, to plant oat hay or potatoes. Using our carriage horse, we kids would have to sit on the harrow to give it weight so it would break up the chunks of earth. As I say, he was a very, very industrious, hard-working man. We lived there at Locust Avenue. Oh, when we moved there, I was six, and the Park School had not yet been built. So we had to enroll in the Homestead Valley Elementary School, which had grades only up, as I recall it, through the fifth. We enrolled there and attended there for about 2 years, during which time the Park School was built, and we were then entered in the Park School.
According to the records I found, Park School opened in April of 09.
Well, that is then when we entered. Park School at that time only consisted of four classrooms and hallways and the principal's office. A Miss Cormack was the principal and the teacher of the fifth grade, a wonderful woman, but with quite a temper and flashing eyes, and we all learned to respect and obey her.
What was her name?
Cormack.
C-O-R?
C-O-R-M-A-C-K. That school only ran through the fifth grade, and at the end of the fifth grade, we had to transfer up to Summit School. One of the rewards of attending Tamalpais School and being a well-behaved student was that the student got to play the drums. The classes marched into school after recess and in the morning and after the noon recess to the tune of a snare drum. The school maintained the drum, and the student who could play the drums and who dusted enough erasers and blackboards was appointed the drummer. And my brother and I were the competitors for it. He was a year older than me. I think he played better than I did. But he went ahead of me because of his being older, and I got to play the drums. We'd sit out on the stairs and during the recesses and expose the drum to the sun, because the sun would tighten the head, tighten the skin, and it would sound better. But in the meantime, we had a pretty good sort of income by letting other kids hold the drum in return for some rewards. The girls marched in from the front of the front yard, the boys from the rear yard. They were pleasant days. Leaving there at the end of the fifth grade, I should then say that my mother and father separated. We moved, my mother and the three children moved over to a small house on Elm Street till we finished at Park School. And then we moved up to a house on the street that runs up
alongside the Keystone Block.
Bernard
Street, yeah. Yes. We rented the small cottage there, and we moved there. Money was a problem. The court had awarded to my mother the 2 acres of fine land down on Blythedale and Sycamore, which was then rented out, but for a nominal sum. And she was awarded $25 a month for the support of 3 teenage children. It wasn't very adequate. So my mother obtained employment at the Pacific Market, owned by Gus Oppenheimer. Gus Oppenheimer was a German Jew, had come to New York and lived there for several years, and then had come out to San Francisco into Marin County. And he, with a partner by the name of Henniker, had operated a butcher store on Blythedale Avenue across from the Crosgrills. There was a commercial, where the Standard Oil Station now is. There was a commercial operation there.
Was it called the Paloma?
I think it was the Paloma.
That's a name I found.
There was a food store there, and I think there was a bar there, too, next to Cavalli's. Then Gus and Henniker had moved their butcher shop up onto Litton Square. It wasn't Litton Square then. They had a shop right next to the railroad, the Mountain Railroad's entrance into the square. And then Gus had gone out by himself, dissolved the partnership, and opened the Pacific Market. In those days, chain grocery stores were still unknown. Automobiles were a rarity, and most of the housewives of Mill Valley wanted the privilege of ordering their food over the telephone and having it delivered to their homes on a credit basis. And Gus operated such a store, credit and service. When I look back on it, it's fantastic. The man worked himself into an early grave. But in that store, he employed my mother as a bookkeeper and answering the 3 telephones, taking orders. He employed 2 full-time butchers in the butcher department, a full-time grocer in the grocery department, a full-time vegetable man in the vegetable department, his own services. He had 3 delivery boys, operated 2 trucks, 2 horses and wagons first, and the third one on Saturdays. Had 3 delivery boys and 2 more on Saturdays, including myself. And then later on, he went into Ford's when automobiles became prevalent. But the man worked awfully hard. And in addition to employing my mother, he hired or rented the right to use our 2 acres of land down on Blythedale Avenue as a pasture for his horses, and a stable for his horses. He used the big stable. His delivery boys would bring the horses down there and turn them loose after the day's work, grain them and feed them. My brother and I would get them into the barn by after dark and get them into their stalls, and the delivery boys would take them out in the morning. Eventually, my mother and Gus Oppenheimer married, and I've never known a finer man. Never. Stern and strict.
How old were you at that time?
I was, at the time they married, I must have been about 14. And I did all the things that the average boy of that age will do, abused privileges. I was angry at Gus because he wouldn't let me use his automobile. I used to borrow his tools and never return them, never put them back. Borrow his neckties and wear them until they were not worth wearing anymore. He tolerated this, but he was always strict. And the older I grew, the more I appreciated him.
How long did you live there? And then he built a new house.
Yes, we lived there until after I married. I married in 1929. I married at the age of 27. We lived there until I was about 35. And then Gus had built a nice new home up at Buena Vista and Sunnyside. for my mother. Harvey Place.
What, Buena Vista and Hill.
And Hill.
Buena Vista and Sunnyside parallel.
That's right. Buena Vista and Hill. That's right. Hill went down there. That's
it's
right.
It's a beautiful house today.
Beautiful house today, yes. And I always regretted my mother sold it. But Gus died in that house. And my mother lived there for a couple of years after, but the memory was too much for her. So she sold it and moved up to San Rafael. But again, getting back to myself, after graduating from grade school, I went to Lick Wilmerdine for 1 year, and then I went to work in San Francisco. I worked first for Shreve & Company. My cousin T. Fred Bagshaw was working for Shreve & Company, and he got me the job. Huge salary was $24 a month. Commute cost $4. I walked. Instead of using streetcars, I walked in the ferry building. I only worked at the Shreve & Company for a few months, and I went to work for the Southern Pacific up in the old flood building, 65 Market Street had not yet been built for their offices. And they paid me the magnificent salary of $30 a month, and I got my commute at half fare, $2 a month.
What'd you do for them?
I was in their motive power department at SP. Motive power department. I loved transportation. I loved locomotives. My job was to sort billings for repair or service to freight cars, to sort them in the names of the various railroads, to accumulate them and pack them and mail them onto the railroad so that they could pay for the service or the repair of their cars. I worked for Southern Pacific for about 3 years. And then I wanted to go to sea, and I did get a berth on the Sonoma, steamship Sonoma. It was subsidiary of the Matson Navigation
Company. Oceanic Steamship Company.
Oceanic Steamship.
I was chief mate on the Sonoma.
You were, eh? Yeah,
but the different one.
Is that so? Yeah. Well, I got a job.
The one that succeeded that.
I got, there were two, I think the Sonoma and the Ventura were
on. Sonoma and Ventura.
And I got a job, as I recall, it was a Sonoma, as a storekeeper. But before I ever went to sea, before on that job, I got employment with Mitsui & Company. Import and export, banking, you name it, they had. They operated the line of a fleet of freighters into San Francisco. My job was the waterfront, the railroad yards, and the steamships, the steamers as they came in. Loved it. They bought me the first automobile I ever had to drive. And I worked outside all the time. I worked there for about 3 years. And I think I spent too much time on the waterfront and in the parks and the like because they let me go. And I then went to work for the wholesale soap company, Clayburgh Brothers, who were extremely good to me. Extremely good to me. I worked there, as I said before, until I lost my 2 weeks salary to the assistant manager in a crap game. Then I continued to work there, but I went out and enrolled in St. Ignatius Law School. At that time, St. Ignatius was the oldest institution of learning in, probably in California. It had been previously located down with the main.
What year are we up to now?
We are now to the time
you went into college.
Well, I
St. Ignatius.
To St. Ignatius, 1922. As I said before, I took a room with an elderly couple on Oak Street. They had a hunchback son who was their principal support. I'm ashamed that I can't remember their name because they were most kind to me. I think I paid $10 a month for my room. I didn't have a private bath. And I went home on the weekends. With that schedule, I didn't have much time for recreation. Saturdays, we had to work a half day at the Silk House, and I'd beat hell out of the little Jewish stock boys if they laid down the job and didn't get the orders out because I had to spend Saturday afternoons in the law library. And then, as I said before, at the end of 2 years of that, I decided to study to be a secretary so I could get employment in a law office and earn a living. And I went to secretarial school for 4 months, and with the help of the old maids who operated it, God love them, they're not in existence anymore, they got me the job as secretary of the U.S. Marshal. I was his secretary and did some work as an outside deputy, transporting prisoners and the like, because I loved to travel. And I met Ed Bonner, who was the agent in charge of the Department of Justice in Northern District of California. We grew friendly, and when Mr. Bonner was appointed Prohibition Administrator for Northern California and Nevada, which was in 1926, he offered me a job in his office, in his legal department, as junior attorney. It was a civil service job, and it was contingent upon my passing the next bar examination and upon my passing a civil service examination. I took the job. The civil service examination was easy, and I was fortunate enough to pass the bar examination, so I had the job. I held it for 3 years, and Mr. Bonner and I got along exceedingly well. I became very active. I was liaison man between that department, which was located in the old Custom House in San Francisco, and the U.S. courts, so I spent a great deal of time in courts. I prepared all applications for search warrants and all search warrants. I disposed of all seized property. We had as many as 100 automobiles and trucks under seizure at one time. The metals, brass, and copper from stills, after they're demolished, I would sell that to the Federated Metals Company in San Francisco, be melted up. I became somewhat of an expert in the law of search and seizure. And Mr. Bonner used to use me for all kinds of critical jobs, emergency jobs. Once he sent me over to Nevada with only a pair of dirty socks as luggage to take to relieve the deputy administrator in charge of Nevada, whom he suspected of being dishonest, and he was right in his suspicions. But I had charge of prohibition enforcement in Nevada for the period of about a week. I was 25 years of age, 26 years of age. It was no place for a kid that age and as inexperienced as me, but I held it and proceeded to try and close all of the famous root houses around Reno and had to leave Nevada in a hurry. But in any event, after 3 years in the Prohibition Department, I was in the corridors of the federal courthouse one day, and George Hatfield, who was United States Attorney at the time, later became Lieutenant Governor, a candidate, unsuccessful candidate for governor, fine man. He stopped me in the corridor, and I was flattered. He said, "Would you like to come into my office as a deputy?" Well, those were political plums, and I was amazed. And he said that the Anti-Saloon League and the State Law Enforcement League were breathing down his neck all the time because his deputies, who were in charge of prohibition prosecutions, were too liberal. They gave the books away. So he said he wanted to placate them, and he thought I would be an appointment which would please them. So he appointed me. And it was the most arduous assignment in the office. We handled and disposed of at least 6 cases every day. Gave me time for nothing else.
These would be cases of bootlegging, rum running?
Bootlegging, rum running, distillery operations and the like, all that sort of thing. I once tied up the entire Coast Guard for 35 days of trial of Johnny Marino and Associates in a conspiracy involving rum running and the operation of the motherships and the landing ships off the coast. And the indicted in that indictment, the directors of the big corporation, now a legitimate corporation, the biggest liquor dealers in Canada, Seagram's, prosecuted that for, I'm not going to mention names in it. I prosecuted that case for 35 days. I think I cost the government millions of dollars. I had all the Coast Guard runners, or Coast Guard vessels tied up.
Why would they be tied up?
Well, they had picketed these rum-running boats off the coast. They had illegal radio transmitters between coast station, land stations and the rum-runners, you see. And they would arrange for a landing at a given spot by using these illegal stations. And we had an outfit known as the Special Agents Department of Justice, all career men. And we had one old man in that, an ex-minister who had been a code breaker in the Army during World War I. And he would break the codes on the radio. He'd solve the codes, and once they broke, we'd be able to read their messages. We'd know where a landing was coming in and when it was coming in, you see. And in order to break them, we had to have constant reports from the Coast Guard cutters, that, for example, that they were tailing the rum runner Hurry Home in a dense fog, and that the Hurry Home evaded them at such and such a location at such a time. We get a message coming in over the illicit radio at that time, and we would assume that they were reporting to their shore station what had transpired. That would enable us to break the code. Yeah.
But why did you have the Coast Guard boats tied up?
Well, there were the revenue cutters that had, the Shoshone and others that had picketed these rum runners for years. I have pictures here which I can show you, which illustrates what I have in mind. The rum runners would anchor a mothership off Ensenada, California, Mexico, rather. This is a picture off Ensenada. I was on the Coast Guard cutter Shoshone when it was taken. That shows the mothership and a rum runner taking on a loading to take up the coast and try to land it. This was the Hurry Home. That was one of the well-known rum runners. They had a center engine, which was a diesel cruising engine, and they had a whole Scott airplane motors in each wing.
Looks like a former Coast Guard boat.
Well, when